You know you make me wanna shout, kick my heels up and shout.
Everyone, I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting but not video streaming today from our studios in New York City, and I'd like to welcome everyone from all over the world. Today, you're going to learn from a University of Southern California study of how a few extra pounds shouldn't be a problem. But it should be. I've been saying this for a long time. There is no such thing as being healthy and being overweight, and another study goes into that. We're going to do just two things today, and that is we're going to do more on health and nutrition, a little longer segment. Then we're going to do a classroom on the air, Vaccines 101. Why? With Dr. Sherry Tenpenny? Because right now, for the millions of individuals, including parents, who trusted that vaccines were necessary to protect their children and other children from diseases, that they just went right up and said to the pharmacist, the nurse, or the physician, go ahead. And unfortunately, they did not do their homework. It's a principle I call intentional neglect. Now, intentional neglect is not just parents. It's those same pharmacists, doctors, and nurses. Everyone believed that nobody would stoop so low as to lie to us about something that was invasive into our system, taking an undeveloped immune system and putting dozens of very toxic elements into that little infant system. Now we end up with an epidemic of autism and autoimmune disorders and asthma and inner ear infections, and we think that's just normal. It is not. So today, a physician, board-certified physician, a woman, a mother, who has done her homework. There are about five women doctors, not men, all women, and all who were pro-vaccine. Most have had academic backgrounds, and yet it was only after they began to do their homework, when they saw anomalies, they saw something that shouldn't happen, completely normal, developing children suddenly regress. And the only mitigating factor was vaccines. So they thought, well, hold on a second. You know, it could be a causal effect or it could be a casual event having nothing to do with the vaccines. They did their homework. Now, because all of these women and all the parents and all the scientists and the physicians and the activists who are now looking at vaccines, studying, becoming knowledgeable, are saying the same thing. Wow. Were we given misinformation? And of course, behind all this is the vaccine industry, which is the pharmaceutical industry, which is making massive profits, and they can't be sued. So, because you're going to be called a domestic terrorist now by the FBI, if you question anything on these topics, any authoritative figure you question that's a member of industry or government, you're now on their watch list. Isn't that something? So we're going to give you the whole information that you need to get you started on a path of learning from Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. Also, once you finish listening to Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, then I suggest that you go up on prn.fm and download the more than 50 articles that Richard Gale and myself have written. These are written in lay language, but they're all fully documented, fully referenced. You could use these in a court of law for evidence. That's the standard by which we create our material. And then you'll see, wow, what if the public had read all these documentaries, materials, articles? And what if they had watched Deadly Deception, the documentary on this? I believe they'd have a completely different point of view, and that's all the more reason for all the social platforms like Google and Facebook, the Australian government, the American government, to virtually ban, censor everything that challenges the status quo on these topics. Because what you don't know, you can't act upon. Keep the public misinformed, uninformed, and hence pliable. That's our program today. Now, there is a study that shows that being overweight increases the chance of premature death. That's right, and that's not me saying, that's University of California researchers. Now, although as a society we accept obesity and accept, well, you shouldn't shame someone, and I totally agree with that. But also, we have to accept now that it shortens your lifespan. And being overweight definitely does not help people live longer. And this was published in the highly respected peer-reviewed journal, The Lancet. And they did a four-continent study looking at 239 separate studies with over 10.6 million people. Wow. That's one of the most definitive studies in history. And so now they're saying physicians identify being overweight as posing risks to health. We should have said this a long time ago. Once again, go back to that principle that we have 1.9 billion out of 7.6 billion people on Earth. That's 39% of all adults who are overweight, as defined by having a body mass index between 25 and 30%. And even 5'4" person weighing 140 pounds is considered healthy, but it's not, because that's a body mass index of 24%. So you're risking dying. So all the more reason to help people who are having trouble with this. And there was a prior paper on this topic published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which found that being overweight actually is an issue. So The Lancet is the most definitive issue on the topic. All right. Separately from Kyoto University in Japan, published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Vascular Surgery, they found that green tea, and specifically EGCG, those are the natural occurring chemicals in the green tea, can help prevent life-threatening artery explosion. What do I mean? I mean that drinking polyphenol-packed green tea could help to prevent a deadly condition in the body's main artery. This was important. Now, you know that when you're eating blueberries and raspberries, strawberries and cherries, you're flooding the body with positive polyphenols. But green tea is right up there. It gives you a lot of it as well. And that helps prevent an aneurysm expansion. The abdominal aneurysm expansion is a serious condition characterized by destruction of the body's main artery. And the life-threatening condition occurs when the main artery becomes overstretched and bloated, resulting in vasodilation, and if left untreated, a rupture that can lead to death in 50% of the cases. So that's important. However, the new study from Kyoto University found that rats fed a green tea extract containing the EGCG developed less frequently the aneurysms than rats that were not. So the type of polyphenol found in green tea has been shown to generate elastin. That's an essential protein that gives the artery its stretchiness and yet a sturdy texture. So green tea can help your arteries prevent this aneurysm and prevent death. All good. From Yakult Central Institute in Japan, fermented soy milk has a chemical or a group of chemicals called isoflavones, I-S-O-F-L-A-V-O-N-E-S, and that can limit ultraviolet damage from the sun. So that's important. And again, this was published in a mainstream medical journal. And researchers from the institute tested female hairless mice, and they fed either fermented soy milk or regular soy milk, and then a control group, and they found that there was a substantial difference in the isoflavone concentrations in the blood and skin, and that was in the body, effectively scavenged the reactive oxygen species generated by ultraviolet radiation, meaning it stopped the radiation from the sun, ultraviolet radiation, from harming the body. So that's good. I mentioned on yesterday's program the importance of folic acid for pregnant women. Well, now there's a separate study from the University of British Columbia published in the peer-reviewed journal Circulation that shows folic acid fortification is linked to lower heart defect rates. That's right. When you have folic acid in the diet, I'm going to suggest 500 micrograms to 1 milligram, that you're going to have less heart abnormalities. That's what it comes down to. Folic acid is really important, and especially it can help prevent things like congenital heart defects. So, and those mean congenital means you're born with it. So it can help prevent the congenital heart defects. That's good. Also, from GreenMedInfo, Jamie Dekoff-Jones, a medical doctor, says, what is the most overlooked effective prescription drug? Now think for a moment. What would it be? Well, it turns out it's hyperbaric oxygen treatment. It's recognized by Medicare in the United States as the reimbursable treatment for 14 approved conditions. Indeed, it is one of the most natural and effective prescriptions offered by conventional medicine today. Why? Okay, let me just do a little tutorial here from their article. First, understand that oxygen makes up almost 21% of every breath that you take. It is fundamental to life. Without it, you're going to die in a few minutes. It is odorless, colorless, that is poorly understood by most doctors, even though it is regulated as a prescription drug in most countries. Many doctors have a visceral mistrust of oxygen due to complicated and erroneous things that we were taught and growing up. And doctors were taught the wrong information in medical school about too much oxygen suppressing the need to breathe in patients with chronic lung disease or causing blindness in premature newborns. Throw in some half-baked ideas about sick people having high free radicals and supplemental oxygen-inducing free radical formation, and there you have it. Well, the overlooked arrow in the quiver, it comes out of the walls at the hospital, is administered by nurses and respiratory therapists, and is generally thought of as an adjunct only, not an important treatment in and of itself, but it is. It is more comfortable for the conventional trained doctor to prescribe even more dangerous drugs when confronting with a chronically ill patient. Doctors generally believe that if the oxygen-carrying capacity of our blood is normal, then you don't need supplemental oxygen. They're wrong, except in a few emergency situations. But many chronically ill people exist in a state of cellular hypoxia. What is hypoxia? H-Y-P-O-X-I-A. It means there's not enough oxygen reaching the inside of the cells to fuel cellular machinery. In particular, oxygen is required inside the mitochondria to act as a substrate for cellular respiration. The Krebs cycle, an oxidative phosphorylation. It produces what is called ATP, adenosine triphosphate. That's the energy inside the cell. Just imagine throwing a log into a fire. That's the ATP. Well, oxygen gets into the cells by passive diffusion along a pressure gradient, And a simple way to think about it is, if the membranes are gummed up by illness, it requires more pressure to push the oxygen in. So there's a vast literature supporting hyperbaric oxygen therapy. It's anti-inflammatory. It's neuroprotective. It's anti-infective and promotes healing of injured tissue. However, access is limited by a short list of indications for which insurance companies will pay hospital exorbitant prices. There's a medical association, I believe it's called the Undersea or Hyperbaric Medical Society, that is the gatekeeper. Anything outside of their list of approved indications is off-label and legal for a doctor to treat, but insurance won't pay for it. So understand that it is very good, especially for stroke. I mentioned that on a program earlier this week, where a person who had a stroke was in a coma, got hyperbaric, and got out of the coma and recovered from the stroke. Now, you've seen some soft portable chambers, or what are called GAMOW bags. They were developed to treat mountain climbers who develop altitude sickness. At the time, that was one of the things that was one of those ooh-ahs. And then we have deep-sea divers using it for decompression, which is a potentially lethal event if you come up too fast from a deep place. In any case, we now have thousands upon thousands of articles about hyperbaric oxygen therapy. And it is really good to protect your brain. I recommend it for people with multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, ALS, especially ALS, and Alzheimer's and dementia. Gulf War illness, chronic Lyme disease. Those are all what I would suggest someone have, and who has those things, to get hyperbaric oxygen therapy. And what happens is this. You kind of go in and you sit in a chamber, and then they have televisions in them, or you read. It's not uncomfortable. You're not claustrophobic. And it has glass so you can see out, and nurses and doctors can see in. And an oxygen concentrator delivers oxygen through a tube to the patient via cannula in the nose, if they're using it that way, or just into the chamber. And that's increasing the available oxygen, and that means that there's benefiting the cells. So, just some things to think about. Also from the Imperial College London, they found that breast milk, sugar, that's naturally produced in the mother, can protect the babies against deadly infections. A type of sugar found naturally in some women's breasts is very protective, especially against the bacteria called Group B Streptococcus, according to the study at the Imperial College London. Now, these bacteria are a common cause of meningitis in newborns and the leading cause of infection in the first 3 months of life globally. And in the new research, 183 women in the Gambia, and published in the journal Clinical and Translational Immunology, found that the sugar in some women's breast milk protects baby against the bacteria. So that's good. One more reason to breastfeed. Also from Radboud University in the Netherlands, they took a look at the omega-3 fatty acids and found it works in helping children diagnosed with ADHD, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which I believe has been grossly overdiagnosed. Normal children's behavior, and it depends upon the child, their disposition, and their conditioning. They may be more aggressive physically. They want to run and jump and climb and yell. And other kids are more shy, and they're more regressed in their emotion. They don't want to go out there. And that both are completely normal. These are not syndromes of a physiopathology, which should be diagnosed and coded and treated. But there are a number of children who I believe have been environmentally or vaccine damaged at the neurological level in a curve. It can be extreme or it can be mild. And that's why sometimes it takes 2, 3, 4 years before you see, wow, you know, my child did not develop at the same level of all of their classmates. So one more reason why we should abolish the vaccine injury court, which is run through the Justice Department, and it's torturous and it's not fair, and instead allow patients who've been damaged by vaccines to sue the manufacturer. Take away the indemnification given to them in 1986. In any case, the omega-3 fatty acids can help that condition. Something else can help us is beetroot or beet juice, just plain old beet juice made from beets. Why? It helps your muscles recover better function and performance, especially if you've had repeated sprint exercises. Now, I don't mention the people I counsel, but some are very famous athletes. And the one thing you hear them talk about all the time is fatigue, pain. Okay, every one of them I'm having to take before they work out, an hour before, beet juice, and afterwards beet juice. Now, there's some other things I suggest they put in the beet juice, but for the average person, beet juice is going to be excellent. This was from Northumbria University. So it can help your muscles, and that's important. Well, we're over a half hour into our program. I said I was going to do a little extended version of our health and nutrition today. I'm going to take a break, and when we come back from the break for the rest of the show, we're going to have a classroom on the air. And this is really important. Now, let's say you don't have children. You think, well, what do I care? You better, if you remember when we were fighting their mandates, you must have a child mandated by law to have vaccines or they can't go into schools. I'm suggesting homeschooling. I'm suggesting moving out of the state, New York, California, and that would be good for you in any case. And because you can only have one mistake with your child, and you could pay for it, and the child pay for the rest of their lives. So go through the discomfort, because the state should not have, in my opinion, the ultimate authority of what is right or wrong for your body. An informed consent, but our doctors are not informed. Nurses are not informed. They're well-intentioned. I'm not blaming them. It's intentional neglect. With all the other information and all the time they're spending treating patients, it's very easy to understand where they wouldn't have 15,000 hours plus, as Dr. Sherry Timpenny, Dr. Tony Bart, and myself and Dr. Nancy Banks and others have spent studying a topic, so we become informed on it. So please listen up. They're going to start mandating adults. They'll start in California using Dr. Pan as the legislative whip to make all this happen. All this will be supported by the pharmaceutical industry, which supported it the last time. So you will only benefit from this. And just to give you an idea, they're now saying, oh, measles, measles, measles. Yeah. And we did the research using the government's own statistics in a 10-year period that was not one single death from the measles. But there were over 100 confirmed deaths from the measles vaccine. So, besides, measles is not a disease. It's an infection. And once you've lived through the infection, which 99.9999% of people do, you're immune for life. But they don't want you to believe that nature is better than their petri dishes and their vaccines. I'm Gary Noll. Hope you're having a wonderful day. We're here every day, Monday to Friday, noon to 1 Eastern Standard Time, and Tuesday, 7 to 8 in the evening with the Progressive Commentary Hour. And we believe in using this as a record of a quality record of source, so you can trust the information because we do our homework. Back in a moment with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny.
everybody. Boy, this is a great group. What a great day to be doing something like this. I mean, it's raining, right? So you can't be out in your garden. You can't be doing anything else like that. So how many of you guys have come to one of these events before? All right, good. So you know that it's a lot of fun, and we're going to be doing a lot of good things. How many have ever heard me speak before? None of you? Wow. Oh, a couple down in the front. Okay. So I just need to make sure. Yeah, there we go. So if that's the case, then let me tell you a little bit about who I am and what I do. So my name is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. I am probably known as the international expert on vaccine injuries and problems associated with vaccines. I've been involved with this for 17 years and about 30,000 hours of my life in terms of research and speaking and traveling around the world giving talks like this. My first career was as a board-certified emergency physician. I was the director of an ER for 12 years. Then I moved to Cleveland, Ohio in 1996, and I opened an integrative medicine practice for which I'm always proud to say we've had people from all 50 states and about 17 foreign countries to come to our clinic to get well and get off their pharmaceutical drugs. So I got involved with this serendipitously, like a lot of things do. I got a notification in the mail in September of 2000 from the National Vaccine Information Center meeting in Washington, D.C. And it was supposed to be in September of that year, and it was really inconvenient for me to go. And I actually went so far as to call them and say, when is your next meeting? Because I don't think I can come this time. And they said, well, we're a small nonprofit. We're not sure we're going to have another one. We said, okay, so every time I went to throw that brochure away off my kitchen counter, it just kind of made its way back onto the kitchen counter. So I was single at the time, and I thought, oh, I know. This is it, Lord. This is where I'm supposed to be to meet the guy. So I went down to the, so I made a reservation. I went down to the meeting, and it wasn't about the guy. It was about the topic. And I sat through 4 days of nonstop lectures, which I think it was the only conference I've ever been to in my entire life that I sat through all of the lectures and took copious notes and heard researchers and PhDs and doctors and parents talk about vaccines and vaccine injuries. There was about 700 people in that conference, a lot of people that were there with their vaccine-injured children in wheelchairs. And all I could think of is, while I was there, was how did I miss this as part of my education as a physician? You know, I've been in medicine at that time for 15 years. I was the director of an ER. I gave out tetanus shots like they were some special kind of candy. I've had my integrative medicine practice now for almost 5 years. And I grew up in a chiropractic family, 3 generations of chiropractors. I wasn't vaccinated as a kid. None of my cousins or any of their kids were vaccinated, so it was never on my radar because I had age-appropriate measles, mumps, rubella, chicken pox, and I had pertussis twice. And I'm 59 and here to talk about it. Nobody died. And so we get so terrorized into these infections that we need to change the language about that because we call them diseases. And everybody gets all weirded out and scared like somebody's going to die over these normal childhood infections that were supposed to come at age-appropriate levels, somewhere mostly between the ages of 6 and 9, that left you with a lifetime of immunity, not only so that you could be healthy as you went into your 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, but that you could pass that health on to your children. So that's how I got involved with this. And after that meeting, I went home and I started saying, well, where do you start? Where do I start looking at this? I know, I'll start with the CDC. So I started going to the CDC documents and read the general recommendations of vaccination, the 1998 version of that, which was such a poorly written paper and such poor documentation. It was a 42-page paper. I still have it, by the way. And I thought, this can't be what this entire industry is built on. This really can't be it. So from there, I started reading all of the mainstream medical literature, the Pediatric Infectious Disease Journal, Vaccine, JAMA, New England Journal of Medicine, and it's all in there. The problems associated with vaccines are in the mainstream medical journals. Physicians just choose to flip right by it because it isn't anything they're interested in reading. So that's how I kind of came to this. And each thing that I read, it became almost like an addiction because I kept thinking, "This, I must be missing something. What am I missing? Where is this? Why can't I find why this is so important?" And the deeper down the rabbit hole I went and the more information that I found, the more shocking it was to me. And I went back to Kathy Williams, who's one of the co-founders of the National Vaccine Information Center, and said, "Surely, if people just knew how vile that stuff was that's coming through the vial, they would like stop and run the opposite direction so fast it looked like the Roadrunner, like beep, beep, psh, be gone. We would implode this industry in like a nanosecond once people understood that there were cells from aborted fetal tissue and aluminum and mercury and formaldehyde and stray viruses that can cause cancer in these things they're given to their children. Surely as soon as they know that, it will stop." Well, you know, 17 years later, we have more vaccines than ever. We have mandates breathing down our neck. We want everybody in the government to take away our rights. So that's why I do this. And that's why, you know, when Patrick heard me talk and I spoke at his meeting last year, he said he wanted me to come up and give this information to all of you on this lecture on Vaccines 101. Because we want to try to boil it down into bite-sized pieces, which, by the way, they're going to be passing around a clipboard for you guys. If you want to be part of my email list and the information we sent out, please just put your name and your email list in a way that, or your email, in a way that I can actually read it. Because it doesn't do any good to write it down if I put an R and it's supposed to be an S into my database. So, because we're pretty active. My Facebook page has 217,000 people. We just started a course called Mastering Vaccine Info, foundational course and online training that we have we've got almost 100 people enrolled in that. It will reopen for enrollment in March. If you want to be on the waiting list for that, let me know. Because it goes through everything. It goes through everything in a way that's bite-sized pieces, about 20 minutes of content, and then the Thursday night Facebook Live discussion group to teach you how to take the language in those modules to become a confident parent, an intelligent leader in your home and your community, and an articulate activist. And that's what we're trying to train everybody to do. So let's get started with this. There are some basic assumptions behind the entire industry of vaccination. In fact, when I got started with this in September of 2000, if you think about the pharmaceutical industry is like a big pie diagram, and a piece of the pie is like cancer drugs, hypertension drugs, you know, all these different drugs that they do, which is all their book of business, their lines of things that they market and sell. At that point in time, the little teeny tiny pie diagram of the vaccine industry was about a $5 billion a year industry. Now they're approaching $54 billion. And why is that so important to know? It's because vaccines, if you vaccinate 100 people, at least 50% of them are going to have a serious side effect. Then you get taken to all of these doctors and all of these tests to find out that, was it the vaccine? Probably not. It was because you had this underlying pathology that was just going to automatically pop up just exactly when you got the vaccine. And then they've got this entire $1 trillion book of business to sell you all these drugs to manage the side effects that you just got from the vaccines. So the vaccines are actually the economical pharmaceutical industry's loss leader. How many of you guys in here have businesses? Or your husband does, or you know, whatever, you have businesses. So you know what a loss leader is, right? A loss leader is like, I'm gonna give away a t-shirt for free. It says on the door, on the sign on your door, free t-shirt, come inside. So you get people to come in for the free t-shirt, so while they're in your door, you can sell them the $1,000 Armani suit. Well, the vaccines are the economic loss leader. Do it for free, mandate it, get your flu shot at every Walgreens, Walmart, every grocery store. I got a thing the other day, they took a picture of it. It said, if you get your flu shot today at Giant Eagle, we'll give you 10% off your groceries. So everywhere, they're pounding people with these vaccines. It's their economic loss leader. Doesn't cost them anything, costs them pennies. And then they've got a $1 trillion book of business to sell you once you start having side effects. asthma, allergies, eczema, ADD, ADHD, ear infections in kids, insulin-dependent diabetes, autoimmune diseases. They have an entire book now, textbook, on vaccines and autoimmune diseases. All of those things start happening, so now we can drive, it's the driver of the entire industry. And these are some of the assumptions, that vaccines are safe. We're gonna go through that in a little more detail. That vaccines are effective, meaning they protect you and keep you from getting sick. That we as physicians and you as a consumer, when you hear the word effective, automatically goes into your head, you think, oh, that keeps me from getting sick. That's not what effective means in the vaccine industry. Vaccines have very few side effects, except for the fact that the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program that went into effect in 1986 and the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System has year-to-date been paid out over $3.2 billion in vaccine injury claims through the government program, and they estimate that's less than 10% of people who've actually been injured. $3.2 billion in vaccine injuries. And every time you read any sort of a paper or you hear anybody on the pro-vaccine advocate side or you hear anybody in the government talk about vaccines, this is what they always say, that they're the most significant public health advances of the 21st century. After all, we saved the world from smallpox and polio, didn't we? We go into that in great detail in my course because actually we didn't. And we've spent billions of dollars for nothing on this polio eradication. But that's another talk for another day. So what about are vaccines safe? And what is the meaning of a safe vaccine? Well, it's not really what you think. That the Webster's Dictionary of Safe says, giving protection, which is what we think it should be. You know, if you have a security system in your house, it keeps you safe. Involving no risk. No risk. Every package insert on every vaccine talks about the risk of vaccination. They are trustworthy and unable to cause trouble or damage. Well, we've already said the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program has paid out $3.2 billion, and all of these vaccine injuries that compound one upon each other creates the business driver for the pharmaceutical industry, so we know that they cause damage. So by definition, they break the definition of what safe is supposed to be. So the real problem then comes with vaccine safety studies. How do they come to the conclusion that they can put in a package insert which is specifically designed for information for your doctor that your doctor is supposed to know? How do they design these studies and come to the conclusion that they are safe? Well, there's four specific problems. And problem number one is that safety studies do not use a true placebo group. And if you take anything away from this talk today, I want you to remember this. Because in conventional medicine, the double-blind, placebo-controlled study is the gold standard for safety. If they're bringing to market, say, a new medication for, say, hypertension, they would give you guys over here the real drug, and you guys over here the sugar pill. And they would want to see of the real drug, compared to the sugar pill, what were the levels of side effects? What kind of reactions did people have? Did it really bring down your blood pressure as compared to this group over here that just got the sugar pill? And when they double-blind it, what that actually means is that the person that you come in to see to participate in the study, when I give you a pill or I give you a pill, I don't know whether I'm giving you the real drug or if I'm giving you the sugar pill. I'm just giving you a pill and then keeping track of your symptoms. So that's a double-blind study. I don't know which of you are getting what. And placebo means it's compared to something that's totally inert. In vaccine studies, they never use a true placebo. And that started all the way back with the polio trials back in 1954 when they did this mass vaccination of the Salk injectable polio vaccine. And they said it was really unethical to give these people a vaccine and to give you nothing if we have to give a shot. So one of the arms of the trial actually gave the placebo as a tetanus shot. So it started way back when that if you're going to get a shot, you ought to have something of value. And so then we get the side effects of the polio vaccine compared to the side effects of the tetanus shot. How can we, and if this has the same amount of side effects as this, then we say it has the same amount of side effects and reactions as the placebo, which was another vaccine. That's not a placebo. And now in the package inserts, what they don't even call it, even try to get away with calling it a placebo anymore. What they call this tetanus shot, this other one that they give you, they call it a comparator. We're going to compare the side effects of the new vaccine compared to the side effects of a vaccine that we already know what those side effects are supposed to be. And if the new vaccine has the same amount of side effects as one that we know is supposed to be there, then we say this new one is safe. There's no true placebo ever. And when I go to talk to doctors and nurses that are in the hospital and they don't have any of this information, when I drop that little factoid of saying that there is no true placebo used when they define safety in a safety trial, I would see it's kind of like a cartoon. It's like their head goes like an eggshell. Like, what do you mean? That's the gold standard for all investigational medicine. Not in the vaccine world, it's not. What they use instead, they consider it unethical to give a vaccine to one group and hold from another group, therefore the placebo should have some benefit. It should be a vaccine. So can you see already where the whole idea that vaccines are safe starts to fall apart from the implementation of the safety studies? They've never really had a safety study. Problem number two is that studies don't use inert substances as a placebo, like a sugar pill is inert. Well, if we're going to compare one vaccine to another vaccine, is this vaccine over here inert? No, because it has its own side effect profile. So the placebo used is often another vaccine, like I said, with a known safety profile. If the experimental vaccine has the same number and types of effects as the placebo vaccine, then the experimental vaccine is said to be safe as placebo. And you see that in all the package inserts. You see that in the published medical literature, in the Pediatric Infectious Disease Journal, or in JAMA, or in the England Journal. They'll say, it was safe as placebo. Then you dig through the study to try to find out what the placebo was. Sometimes they list it, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes you have to go to the FDA and look at the original trials to find out what the placebo was. But most of the time, it was another vaccine. Another example is that in the Gardasil trials, that they actually used an injection of aluminum as the placebo. Gardasil has, has the highest amount of aluminum of any vaccine, but there's new vaccines that have come out that have larger amounts of aluminum. The Gardasil 4 that came out in 2006 had 250 micrograms of aluminum. Now Gardasil 9 that came out a couple of years ago and has become the one that they give everyone around the world has 500 micrograms of aluminum. And we're going to see in a few minutes that the new meningitis B vaccine has 1,500 micrograms of aluminum, which is a big deal. So this is where in Gardasil, you know what Gardasil is? Gardasil is the vaccine that they want to give all the girls to say one less girl. Yeah, when they say one less girl, I always, what goes in my mind is one less girl able to have children in the future is what the rest of that sentence should be. Because Gardasil has been shown to cause testicular atrophy in male mice and stop periods and atrophy of the uterus in female mice. So Gardasil is this vaccine that was only tested on 12,000 girls before they started administering it to 9 to 12-year-old girls of age back in 2006. Most vaccine clinical trials on an international basis have tens of thousands of people. This one was only tested on 12,000. They were followed for only 6 months, when in vaccine trials, they usually follow things for about 4 years, and in medication trials, they follow them for longer than that. The observation for adverse events was 15 days. How long does it take for an autoimmune reaction to form? Months. They only followed this because all they were looking for was acute allergic reactions, swollen arm, sick to their stomach, headache. They only followed it for 15 days. The average age for developing cervical cancer is somewhere between 38 and 42. And the placebo that was used was a shot of aluminum, and Gardasil has aluminum in it. So each Gardasil dose has 225 micrograms of aluminum, and about 25% experienced the injection and pain after the Gardasil, and about 16% had pain after the shot of aluminum, the conclusion was Gardasil was declared to be as safe as the placebo. Which is pretty common. I mean, this is just one example that I could give you of the 56 vaccines that are currently approved in the U.S. market, and there are almost 310 in the developmental pipeline. Now, some of the vaccines in the developmental pipeline are specific indicators. A lot of them are in the cancer segment because what they're trying to do is come up with DNA vaccines to manipulate your DNA and genetics. Nothing could go wrong with that, right? Nothing could possibly go wrong with a DNA vaccine to change your genetics permanently and then pass that on to your children. But all of the vaccines, and then they are coming up with specific indicator vaccines. Like there's a vaccine under development for cocaine addiction, one for hypertension, one for periodontal disease. So they're trying to eliminate dentists? I mean, I don't know. But these are the sorts of things that are in development down the way. And so this was the vaccine that came to market that currently there are 7 countries around the world that are about to ban the use of Gardasil and the international equivalent, which is called Cervarix, because of all the deaths and chronic long-term disability that's being caused by this vaccine. So if you've got kids that are coming up, teenagers, please get educated about this vaccine. And if there were any of them that you were going to refuse, I mean, in my opinion, that you should refuse all of them. But if you were going to refuse any, absolutely do not allow your kids to get this vaccine. Because they're giving it to boys now, too. They started that about 5 years ago, primarily because they wanted to double their market share. They felt like they were missing out on half the population. And because we know that those dirty little 9-year-old boys are going to be having sex with those promiscuous 9-year-old girls, and they're going to be sharing their HPV viruses back and forth. Because that's the age group that you have to give this, because if you give it after you've had intercourse, it doesn't work. 100% of the female population, well, let me say that again. They estimate somewhere between around 98% of the entire female population has an HPV infection sometime in their life. I mean, the cervix is an external organ, right? It's like your nose. It's an external organ. And about 98% of people actually have that infection sometime in their life. And somewhere close to 97.5% of people who have the infection clear it in 2 years or less. So we're actually giving a vaccine because less than 2% of all humanity gets this vaccine and it doesn't, or gets the virus, and it doesn't go away within 2 years. And maybe, maybe not causes cancer, but we're going to vaccinate the entire global population and destroy the lives of hundreds, if not thousands, of teenagers for really something that can be prevented with a pap smear. I know, this is supposed to be like a celebration, right? Isn't this kind of like heavy? Remember, Patrick Vita be here, right? So we got to keep this a little bit light. So here's the light side I was telling you. This is all the different concentrations of aluminum now. And we know that aluminum causes Alzheimer's. We're pretty sure that aluminum contributes to other types of neurological conditions. Aluminum, once it's injected, it stays in the muscle for an extended period of time, and it's really not cleared from the body. So poison for poison, in the last decade, many studies in animal models have repeatedly demonstrated that aluminum can inflict immune-mediated diseases, autoimmune, neurological, and skin disorders. But yet we've got all of those vaccines that have aluminum in them, including the hepatitis B vaccine that's given at birth. So if you get a vitamin K shot and a hepatitis B vaccine at birth, you get 330 micrograms of aluminum injected into your baby before they're 2 days old. And so then if they have problems down the road, how do you know? Because now the doctors will say, well, they were just born that way. Were they? Or was it all that gunk that you injected into them as soon as they landed on the planet? So, now what about, so a few more problems with social study, or with safety studies. So far we've said what? There's no placebo. They don't use an inert substance. Problem number 3, vaccine trials usually include 3 injections to create an antibody response. So they give the first one, they say that primes the pump, the second one locks in immunity, and the third one we want to take those antibodies to the moon. We want to make them sure that we make them as high as we possibly can because they all degrade and go away with time because it's false, fake immunity. It's not even immunity. It's vaccination. It's not giving your kids or you an immune response. It's injecting foreign matter into your body to create an antibody that we somehow think is going to protect you, which it doesn't. So the vaccine trials, the babies experience the side effects after the first dose, he or she is dropped out from the trial, and the data is analyzed on those that are remaining in the trial at the end. And the negative consequences of side effects are left out. So let's boil that down into some really simple terms. Let's say that there were 1,000 babies in this clinical trial. And after the first vaccine, 100 of them dropped out because of side effects. And after the second vaccine, another 100 dropped out because of side effects. And after the third vaccine, another 100 of them dropped out because of side effects. When they look at the results and they look at the safety of this particular vaccine, they do the analysis on the 700 that were left. They don't even talk about the other 300 that dropped out, except to say study investigators feel that none of the side effects were attributable to the vaccines. None of the side effects were attributable to the vaccines for any of those 300 that dropped out. And so with a stroke of a pen, in any vaccine safety or efficacy study, they just wipe it out. Gone, deleted, hit the cutting room floor, does not apply. And then they look at the rest of the analysis and say, well, it was as safe as placebo. So now we go to stage four clinical trials. Stage one is bringing it to market. Stage two is small trials. Stage three is those 1,000 people, babies we talked about. Now we just release it on humanity. That's stage four clinical trials. And they call it post-marketing surveillance to see how many people die or have serious consequences once we've unleashed it on humanity. And then everybody that reports a side effect or a problem, they go, well, we don't know if we can trust that report. It was just spontaneously reported, and maybe they were lying. Maybe it had nothing to do with the vaccine. So it's all negated. Anything that is not just safe and effective is just one way or another deleted from the entire industry. So what was problem number three? They only analyze when people drop out, side effects, they aren't taken into consideration. And problem number four, which I think is also a really serious complication, is when they set up a clinical trial, they only enroll healthy children or healthy adults. I mean, if you are a child and you have asthma, allergies, seizure disorders, autoimmune problems, you're not allowed into the vaccine study. You're not allowed in there. Same thing as if you're an adult. So you have to be like a healthy adult, and no medications, no underlying conditions that we know of. So now we'll do the studies on you. So children with chronic illnesses are excluded, even though those are the children who are most advocated to receive the vaccine after it comes to market, or the adult that's most advocated to receive it. So if your children have, say, asthma, and they were excluded completely from this new vaccine, say a new flu shot, once that new flu shot gets approved, your pediatrician will hammer you over the head to give your kid with asthma this new shot because, oh my God, you can't let them get sick. And so if you get this vaccine, it's going to keep them from getting sick. And they are the most susceptible because they do have an underlying condition, even though the clinical trials never included any of those kids to begin with. So this is just one example. This was Prevnar 7. They now have Prevnar 13. So it has so if you get a Prevnar 13 shot, that's like getting 13 vaccines in one needle. And you get 5 of those at 2, 4, 6 months, 1 year, and they sometimes give a booster at 5 years of age. And this is what it says right from the study, right? Healthy infants were randomized 1-to-1, meaning you had 800 healthy kids and you've divided them into two groups, to receive either Prevnar 7 or a meningitis C vaccine. Huh, there's that comparator of another vaccine, to get it at 2, 4, 6 months and somewhere between 12 and 15 months of age. Children with sickle cell, known immunodeficiency, and any serious chronic progressive disease, a history of seizures, a history of either type of pneumococcal or meningococcal meningitis were excluded. But when Prevnar came to market, the number one target were kids with those conditions. Chronic ear infections, immunodeficiencies, sickle cell, so kids that don't have a spleen. They were the ones who were absolutely advocated to get this vaccine, even though they were never tested in any of the clinical trials against kids who were chronically ill. So I love this. This is my favorite quote. Figures don't lie, but liars do figure. So they can take any statistic they want and twist it around and manipulate it, cut out the kids that had side effects, you know, don't include kids that were sick, you know, never use a true placebo, use something like a shot of aluminum, that's good enough. So they can really figure it around whatever they want. So what are those takeaways? Safety studies don't prove safety. In fact, the U.S. Supreme Court has actually ruled that vaccinations are unavoidably unsafe. Unavoidably unsafe by the U.S. Supreme Court. The one-size-fits-all vaccination schedule is dangerous and it's unproven, and I think it's a fraud. Every vaccine is different. Every combination in that vaccine is a little bit different. And every time it gets injected into you or your children, I mean, there's like 300 people in here. How many different sets of genes do we think we have in here?
By the way, there's going to be a second part to this. That was just part one. Anyhow, I hope you're having a wonderful time today, and I look forward to sharing more with you tomorrow. Thank you for listening, everyone, and have a nice day.